Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Have you ever come across a historical figure who just seems like a total contradiction, like a walking paradox?
Oh, absolutely. It happens more often than you'd think, especially in politics.
Right. So picture this. A man everyone says is charming, really popular, a successful lawyer, even becomes a brigadier general, you know, a war hero.
It sounds impressive. Got all the credentials, seemingly.
Exactly. But then you look at the history books, the rankings, and he's almost always listed as one of the worst, or at least memorable, presidents the U.S. has ever had.
Wow. Yeah, that is quite a disconnect. How does someone with that kind of personal appeal end up with such a, well, such a negative historical judgment?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it really highlights how the pressures of the presidency, especially during a really volatile time, can just break someone or expose flaws that weren't obvious before.
It does. Personal charm doesn't always equal effective leadership, especially when a nation is tearing itself apart.
Precisely. And that's exactly what we want to explore today. We're doing a deep dive into the life and incredibly turbulent presidency of Franklin Pierce. He was the 14th president, serving from 1853 to 1857.
Right, and that incredibly tense lead up to the Civil War.
Exactly. So our goal here is to unpack the complexities of Pierce's story. We'll look at his personal struggles, which were frankly immense. We'll examine his political ideas and, crucially, the huge national events he was trying to handle, or maybe failed to handle.
Events that really pushed the country closer and closer to war.
No doubt. By the end of this, you should have a much more nuanced picture of this often overlooked president whose decisions, for better or worse, had massive consequences for where the nation was headed.
And to do that, we've gathered quite a range of sources. We've got biographical accounts, historical analyses. We've even looked into his personal letters to try and get a sense of the man himself.
Yeah, trying to get beyond just the official portrait, you know, understand his motivations, the pressures he was under.
It was an incredibly challenging time. So where do we start?
His early life. Let's do that. Let's go back to the beginning. Franklin Pierce was born November 23, 1804. And get this, in a log cabin. Hillsboro, New Hampshire.
Humble beginnings, then.
Very much so. He was the fifth of eight kids. His father, Benjamin Pierce, was a pretty significant figure, fought in the Revolutionary War, later became governor of New Hampshire. His mother was Anna Kendrick.
So politics and military life were in his blood, essentially.
Absolutely. It wasn't just background noise. It was the family business, in a way. His dad was deep into state politics. His older brothers fought in the War of 1812. Duty, military tradition that was baked in from the start.
You can see how that might shape someone.
Definitely. And there's this one story from when he was 12 that he himself called the turning point in my life.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah. Okay, so apparently he got really homesick at school. So homesick, he walked 12 miles back home one Sunday.
12 mile. Wow. Okay.
So he gets home expecting maybe some sympathy. No, his dad feeds him dinner, drives him partway back to school, and then makes him walk the rest of the way by himself in a thunderstorm.
Whoa. That's intense parenting. Character building, I suppose, in the extreme.
Right. It makes you wonder, you know, did that build resilience? Or did it teach him a certain kind of obedience, maybe? It's a stark image.
It really is. It speaks volumes about the kind of tough, almost unforgiving environment he grew up in. Not a lot of coddling there.
Seems like it. And that drive, that toughness, whether it was innate or instilled, it definitely seems to have propelled him forward.
So after that turning point, where did he go next? College.
Yep. Bowdoin College in Maine, started in 1820. But interestingly, he wasn't exactly a star student right away.
No. You'd think with that background.
Well, he actually hit rock bottom academically, dead last in his class after 2 years.
Really? Last? Okay, that's surprising.
But he turned it around, buckled down, focused, and ended up graduating fifth in his class in 1824. Quite a comeback.
That shows some grit. Definitely.
And Bowdoin was important for connections, too. He became really good friends with Nathaniel Hawthorne. Yes, that Nathaniel Hawthorne.
The author. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Hawthorne later became his biographer. Also became close with Jonathan Silly, another future politician. And John P. Hale was there, too. started as an ally,
yeah.
later became a major political rival.
So key relationships formed early on.
For sure. And he wasn't just hitting the books. He showed that leadership streak again. Organized and led this unofficial student militia, the Bowdoin Cadets.
A militia in college.
Yeah, apparently they drilled on campus. The college president wasn't thrilled, tried to shut them down, and it led to a student strike. Pierce was even suspected of being one of the ringleaders.
Huh. So a bit of a rebel, too. Charismatic, maybe not the most studious at first, but definitely a leader.
That seems to be the picture. Classmates remembered his social skills more than his grades. That charisma, that hint of rebellion, plus the interest in military stuff, you can see the seeds of his future career there.
It sets the stage nicely. So yeah. After Bowdoin Law School.
He studied law, yeah.
Yeah.
Got admitted to the New Hampshire bar in late 1827. Apparently he lost his very first case, which must have stung.
Ouch. Not a great start.
But he recovered quickly. Became known for having a great memory, especially for names and faces, which is always useful in law and politics. Plus that charm and a deep voice that commanded attention.
And he apparently did a fair bit of pro bono work. Representing the poor.
He did, which, you know, certainly didn't hurt his popularity. And he jumped into politics almost immediately.
Didn't waste any time.
Nope. Became Hillsborough's town meeting moderator in 1828. Got reelected 5 times. Then into the New Hampshire House of Representatives. And get this, by 1831, he's the Speaker of the House at age 27.
27. That's incredibly young to be Speaker. He must have made connections fast.
He clearly had talent for the political game. He used that position to push the Democratic agenda, opposed expanding banks, defended the state militia, supported Andrew Jackson nationally.
So a rapid rise fueled by charisma and political skill. The militia interest keeps popping up, too.
It does. It seems like a consistent thread. But even then, his letters apparently show him kind of lamenting being single, wishing for a life outside of politics. That tension was there early on.
Hmm. That desire for a different kind of life becomes really important when we look at his marriage, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Tell us about Jane Appleton.
Right. So he marries Jane Means Appleton in 1834, and she was, in many ways, his complete opposite. Described as pious, very reserved, deeply religious, strong temperance supporter.
So not exactly the life of the political party.
Not at all. And she suffered from chronic health problems, likely tuberculosis, maybe psychological issues too. And she hated politics. Loathed Washington, D.C.
Oh boy. That sounds like a recipe for tension.
Constant tension, it seems. His ambition versus her desire for a quiet, private life. But the real tragedy, the thing that just hangs over everything, is what happened to their children.
Yeah, this is incredibly sad.
They had 3 sons. Franklin Jr. died just days after birth.
Awful.
Then their second son, Frank Robert, died at age 4 from typhus.
Oh my goodness. 2 children lost.
And then Benjamin, their last surviving son, he was 11 years old. Just weeks before Pierce's inauguration, the family was on a train.
The Andover train accident. I've read about this. It's horrifying.
It is. The train car derailed, rolled down an embankment. Benjamin was killed instantly, crushed. Apparently, it was a horrific scene, and Pierce couldn't shield Jane from seeing it.
I can't even begin to imagine. Losing one child is devastating, but all 3. And the last one in such a traumatic way, right before becoming president.
Exactly. And you have to ask, how could that not profoundly affect him? His judgment, his emotional state, his ability to lead. Jane was plunged into deep depression, reportedly believing it was God's punishment for Franklin pursuing the presidency.
That's just soul-crushing. It puts his entire presidency in a different light, doesn't it? Starting under such a dark shadow.
An almost unbearable shadow. And it certainly colored his time in national politics even before the presidency.
Right. Let's talk about his time in Congress. He served in the House, then the Senate, through the 1830s and early 40s.
Still a loyal Jacksonian Democrat.
Very much so. Opposed the National Bank, opposed federal money for things like canals and roads, saw it as federal overreach, states' rights infringement, standard Democratic positions back then.
Okay, but the big issue, the one that was starting to dominate everything, was slavery. Where did he stand then?
This is where it gets really complicated and crucial. Personally, he seems to have disliked slavery. He wrote things like, "I consider slavery a social and political evil, and most sincerely wish that it had no existence."
So morally opposed them?
Morally opposed, yes, but politically. He saw the abolitionist movement as the biggest threat to keeping the Union together. He thought their agitation, as he called it, had to be stopped, or the country would break apart.
The classic conflict, personal morals versus perceived political necessity or union preservation.
Exactly. He believed federal action against slavery violated states' rights. He even supported the gag rule in the House, which basically prevented any debate on anti-slavery petitions.
So receive the petitions, but immediately table them, effectively silencing the issue in Congress.
Right. It's this stance, personally disliking slavery, but politically defending the South's right to it and prioritizing the Union above all else, that really defined him. That's why he got labeled a doughface.
A Northerner with Southern sympathies. That term really captures the growing divide.
It does. And that internal conflict, that prioritizing of union over abolition, sets the stage for everything that happened during his presidency.
It really does. Okay, so after Congress, he steps back from D.C. for a bit, right? But then the military dream calls again.
Yes. The Mexican-American War. This is something he'd apparently wanted for a long time, influenced by his father and brothers. He gets appointed a colonel, then quickly promoted to brigadier general in 1847.
Leads a brigade down to join General Scott's army. A pretty tough march, wasn't it?
Yeah, 3 weeks through difficult terrain. And his actual combat experience was, well, eventful.
Yeah.
And not entirely positive, at least initially.
Right, the Battle of Contreras. What happened there?
His horse got spooked, threw him against the saddle, then tripped and fell, pinning Pierce's leg underneath. Caused a really bad knee injury.
Ouch. And that led to accusations.
Unfortunately, yes.
Oh.
Because he was incapacitated, maybe fainted from the pain. Some accused him of cowardice.
Politics, even on the battlefield, huh?
Seems like it. But he showed serious grit. He went back into action the next day despite the injury and actually re-injured the knee.
Okay, that takes some guts.
Then, at the Battle of Churubusco, the pain was apparently so bad they had to tie him to a saddle to keep him upright. He eventually passed out from the pain right there on the battlefield. Also suffered from severe dysentery during the battle for Mexico City.
Tied to his saddle. Wow. So despite the injuries and the initial accusation, he stuck it out.
He did. Completed his service, participated in capturing Mexico City, and when he got back to New Hampshire, he got a hero's welcome.
So the military service, even though brief and difficult, it definitely boosted his public image, gave him that war hero credential.
Absolutely. Which, as we know, was often a golden ticket in 19th century presidential politics.
But that cowardice accusation lingered, didn't it?
It did. Our sources say it would long shadow him, which makes Ulysses S. Grant's later comments even more interesting.
Grant. What did he say? He served with Pierce in Mexico, right?
He did. And later, in his memoirs, Grant, who, remember, wasn't a political ally of Pierce, wrote, "Whatever General Pierce's qualifications may have been for the presidency, he was a gentleman and a man of courage."
Huh. That's a pretty strong defense from someone who saw it firsthand and had no political reason to praise him.
Exactly. It's a valuable counterpoint to the caricature. It reminds us that battlefield narratives can be messy, and personal courage doesn't automatically equate to political success, or vice versa.
A really important distinction. Okay, so he's got the war hero status, the political background. How does he end up getting the presidential nomination in 1852? He wasn't exactly a front runner, was he?
Not at all. He was a classic dark horse. The Democratic Party was tearing itself apart over slavery. Everyone expected the 1852 convention to deadlock between the big names like Cass, Buchanan, Douglas.
A recipe for a compromise candidate.
Precisely. Pierce's allies saw an opening, especially after another potential compromise figure, Levi Woodbury, died. They started quietly pushing Pierce.
And Pierce himself, was he actively campaigning?
Publicly? No way. He followed the custom of pretending not to want it, saying a nomination would be utterly repugnant to my tastes and wishes.
Ah, the standard political dance.
Right. But privately. He let his supporters work the convention floor. And crucially, he wrote letters confirming his support for the Compromise of 1850, including the Fugitive Slave Act.
Ah, reassuring the South. A calculated move.
Very calculated.
Yeah.
And it worked. After ballot, 48 of them. With no winner, the exhausted convention finally turned to Pierce on the 49th ballot. William R. King from Alabama became his running mate.
49 ballots. Wow. So he really was chosen because nobody hated him too much. A unifier, in theory.
That was the idea. Someone acceptable to both Northern and Southern Democrats. But you have to ask, did being a compromise chosen out of desperation just set him up to fail when things got really tough?
That's a very good question. And the reaction to his nomination at home was dramatic.
Understatement. His wife, Jane, reportedly fainted when she heard the news.
Fainted, oh dear.
And their son, Benjamin, the one who later died in the train crash, wrote to his mom saying he hoped his father wouldn't win because he knew how much he hated Washington.
Good grief. That really speaks volumes about the personal cost and maybe his own reluctance deep down.
It really does. And that reluctance, that family unhappiness, just tragically foreshadowed the absolute horror that came next.
The train accident. Just weeks after the election.
January 6, 1853. Pierce, Jane, and 11-year-old Benjamin are on that train near Andover, Massachusetts. It derails.
And Benjamin is killed right in front of them.
Horrifically. Crushed. Nearly decapitated, an image neither parent could ever forget. It plunged them both into just overwhelming grief.
And Jane felt it was punishment.
Apparently so. Punishment for his ambition, for seeking the presidency. She wrote this heartbreaking letter of apology to Benny for her failings as a mother. She barely participated in White House social life for the first 2 years.
How could anyone function under that? It's often cited as crippling his presidency before it even began.
It has to be considered. He was emotionally shattered, heading into arguably the toughest job in the world during one of the country's most dangerous periods. It's critical context.
Absolutely critical. So he goes to the inauguration alone. Jane didn't accompany him.
No, she stayed behind, still consumed by grief. And at the inauguration, Pierce did a couple of notable things. First, he affirmed the oath of office on a law book, not a Bible.
Only the second president to do that, after John Quincy Adams. Interesting choice.
Yeah, maybe suggesting a more secular view. And second, he delivered his entire inaugural address from memory. First president ever to do that.
Wow, that takes some confidence, or maybe just a good memory. What was the tone of the address?
He talked about peace and prosperity at home, but also pushed hard for American expansion abroad. He embraced that young America idea, acquiring new territories was eminently important.
So, Manifest Destiny was alive and well in his administration.
Very much so. He actually said, "The policy of my administration will not be deterred by any timid forebodings of evil from expansion." Strong words.
Did he mention slavery?
He avoided the word itself, but he talked about putting the important subject of sectional conflict to rest, emphasizing unity. And he made that poignant comment, clearly alluding to his personal loss. "You have summoned me in my weakness. You must sustain me by your strength."
Heartbreaking. And then adding to the rough start, his vice president died almost immediately.
Yeah, William R. King was already ill with tuberculosis, went to Cuba hoping the climate would help, was sworn in there, but died just over a month into the term.
Leaving the VP office vacant for almost the entire presidency.
Exactly. There was no mechanism back then to replace a VP.
Yeah.
So the Senate president pro tempore was next in line. Just another layer of instability.
What a start. Grief. No VP, expansionist talk, and the slavery issue simmering. Did he manage to get anything done on the administrative side?
Surprisingly, yes. Despite the political turmoil and his personal state, his administration did achieve some significant, often overlooked, administrative reforms.
Like what?
Well, he tried to unify the Democratic Party by appointing people from different factions to his cabinet. That mostly backfired. Everyone accused him of favoring the other side. But remarkably, that entire original cabinet stayed with him for all 4 years.
The only time in U.S. history that's happened. Wow.
Yep. And they did some solid work. They started early forms of civil service exams trying to base appointments on merit, not just who you knew.
A precursor to later reforms. Interesting.
His Interior Secretary, Robert McClellan, really cleaned house in that department, rooting out fraud. Pierce gave the Attorney General more power over appointing federal judges and attorneys, a step towards the modern Justice Department.
Okay, so some real efforts at efficiency and accountability.
Definitely. Treasury Secretary James Guthrie went after corruption, tried to get federal money out of private banks, and Jefferson Davis, his Secretary of War.
Later President of the Confederacy.
Yeah, right. He oversaw surveys for the transcontinental railroad routes, seeing it as vital for national security. Also managed construction projects in D.C., so there was this side of Pierce committed to decent governance.
It's that paradox again. Capable administrator, but overshadowed by the huge political failures.
Exactly. And those political failures were deeply tied to his foreign policy, too.
The young America expansionism, how did that play out?
Well, Secretary of State William Marcy tried to project this distinctively American image, diplomats wearing plain clothes instead of fancy European court dress, that sort of thing.
A symbolic gesture. Any tangible gains?
Yes, the Gadsden Purchase.
Yeah.
They bought a chunk of land from Mexico, southern Arizona, part of New Mexico. Congress haggled the price down, but it finalized the southern border of the contiguous U.S., more or less.
Okay, that's significant.
They also signed a trade reciprocity treaty with Britain regarding Canada. Pierce hoped it might lead to annexing Canada eventually. And the trade treaty with Japan, opened by Commodore Perry, was finalized under Pierce, though initiated earlier.
So some diplomatic successes. But there was a major controversy too, right? Cuba?
Well, yeah. The Ostend Manifesto. This was a huge blunder. Three U.S. diplomats in Europe secretly proposed buying Cuba from Spain for a hefty sum.
Okay, buying it.
But then they added that if Spain refused, the U.S. should consider wresting it away by force.
Wow, just take it. That sounds aggressive.
Extremely. And when this secret proposal leaked, the North went ballistic. They saw it as a blatant attempt to grab more slave territory for the South.
So it backfired badly, made the administration look like it was driven by pro-slavery expansionism.
Completely. It damaged the whole idea of manifest destiny in many Northern eyes and fueled suspicions about Southern intentions. It shows how domestic slavery politics poisoned even foreign policy goals.
And that brings us squarely to the biggest domestic disaster, the Kansas-Nebraska Act.
Absolutely. The defining and arguably most destructive act of his presidency.
It all started with Senator Stephen Douglas wanting to organize the Western Territories, right? For a railroad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Douglas from Illinois wanted a transcontinental railroad that would benefit his state. To do that, he needed to organize the huge Nebraska Territory. But to get Southern votes for his plan, he needed to offer them something.
And that something was slavery.
Precisely. He proposed popular sovereignty. Let the settlers in the new territories decide for themselves whether to allow slavery.
Which sounds democratic on the surface.
But it directly attacked the Missouri Compromise of 1820. That compromise had banned slavery north of a specific line, 36 degree 30 yard latitude, for over 30 years, keeping a fragile peace.
So Douglas's plan would just erase that line?
Effectively, yes. His bill split the territory into two. Nebraska in the north, expected to be free, and Kansas in the south, expected or hoped by the South to become slave.
Did Pierce support this immediately? It seems like throwing gasoline on a fire.
He was initially hesitant. He knew it would cause a massive uproar in the North. But Douglas, along with Jefferson Davis, Pierce's own Secretary of War, pressured him hard. They eventually convinced him to back the bill.
A fatal decision in hindsight.
Absolutely catastrophic. It shattered the uneasy truce over slavery, reignited the conflict with incredible fury, and directly contradicted Pierce's own promise to keep the issue settled. It unleashed chaos.
And that chaos became known as Bleeding Kansas.
Yep. As soon as the act passed, pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers flooded into Kansas, both sides determined to win the territory. It got violent fast.
And there were problems with the voting, right? The border ruffians.
Huge problems. Thousands of pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border just to vote illegally in Kansas territorial elections. They completely skewed the results, electing a pro-slavery legislature.
So a fraudulent election, basically. How did Pierce react?
This is key. Despite knowing about the fraud, Pierce backed the pro-slavery legislature. He called the rival anti-slavery government set up by the Free Staters with their Topeka Constitution an act of rebellion.
So he sided with the outcome achieved through fraud.
He did. He recognized the pro-slavery government and even sent federal troops to break up meetings of the anti-slavery group. He was committed to the principle of popular sovereignty, even if the process was corrupt.
Wow. That must have enraged the North, made him look totally biased towards the South.
It absolutely did. It cemented the view of him as a dirtface and made a mockery of his claims to be a unifier. It just deepened the wounds.
And at the same time, all this is happening in Kansas, he's also cracking down on fugitive slaves back east.
Yes, the Anthony Burns case in Boston. It happened right around the same time as the Kansas-Nebraska debate. Burns, an escaped slave, was captured in Boston.
Boston being a hotbed of abolitionism, that must have caused an uproar.
Massive protests, fury in the streets. But Pierce was adamant about enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act. He saw it as his constitutional duty.
Regardless of the moral implications or public opinion in the North?
Exactly. He sent federal troops, marshals, even ships, spending a huge amount of money just to ensure Burns was forcibly returned to his owner in Virginia.
What a powerful symbol. Federal power used explicitly to uphold slavery against the wishes of a northern city.
For abolitionists and many northerners, it was just another slap in the face. It proved the federal government under Pierce was actively propping up the slave system. It further alienated huge segments of the population.
So, leading Kansas, Anthony Burns, the political consequences must have been enormous.
Transformative. The whole party system basically exploded. The Whig Party just disintegrated over the slavery issue. Couldn't hold the Northern and Southern wings together anymore.
And what rose from the ashes?
Two main groups initially. The American Party, or Know-Nothings. They were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, tapping into nativist fears. They had a brief surge.
But the bigger one was the Republicans, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Republican Party was founded specifically in response to Kansas-Nebraska, dedicated to stopping the expansion of slavery. It drew anti-slavery Whigs, Democrats, free soilers, a powerful new coalition based entirely in the North.
So Pierce's actions directly led to the creation of the party that would eventually elect Lincoln.
You could definitely argue that. The midterm elections in 1854-55 were a disaster for the Democrats outside the South. The political map was being completely redrawn along sectional lines, largely because of the fallout from Pierce's policies.
It really accelerated the path to war. Okay, so after all that, did he seriously expect to be renominated in 1856?
Amazingly, yes. He fully expected the Democratic nomination. But the party leaders knew better. They saw how unpopular he was in the North, how toxic, bleeding Kansas had become. He was an electoral liability.
So the convention in Cincinnati, it wasn't smooth sailing for him?
Not at all. On the first ballot, James Buchanan actually had more votes than Pierce. Pierce's support was mostly from the South. It deadlocked.
How many ballots this time?
14 deadlocked ballots. Pierce's support was fading. He finally saw the writing on the wall and withdrew.
Did he throw his support to anyone?
Yeah, he tried to get his delegates to back Stephen Douglas, hoping to stop Buchanan. But Douglas, probably figuring 1860 would be his year, also withdrew. That sealed it for Buchanan.
So Pierce became the first elected president actively seeking renomination to be denied by his own party.
That's right. A pretty stunning rejection. It just shows how badly his presidency had damaged the party and the country in their eyes. They needed someone who wasn't so directly tied to the Kansas fiasco.
A brutal end to his time in office. Did he just fade away after that?
Not entirely. He remained outspoken, especially as the country spiraled towards war. He kept blaming Northern abolitionists, urging them to back off to avoid secession. He even called New England ministers preaching abolition guilty of heresy and treason.
Strong words. How did he react when the war actually started?
He was highly critical of Lincoln. He strongly opposed Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus, the right to not be detained without charge. He sided with the Peace Democrats, who prioritized civil liberties even in wartime.
Which probably didn't win him many friends in the North during the war.
Definitely not. It reinforced his image as a Southern sympathizer. There was even this bizarre incident where a hoax letter surfaced accusing him of being part of some plot against Lincoln.
A plot? Seriously?
Yeah, it led to a public spat with Secretary of State Seward. Pierce had to have his personal letters read in Congress to clear his name. But he kept criticizing Lincoln, accusing him of abusing presidential power. He called the war cruel, heartless, aimless, unnecessary.
Wow. So he remained defiant and deeply unpopular in the North right through the war.
Pretty much. His criticism of Lincoln cemented that negative legacy for many. He was seen by some as almost treasonous.
And his personal life after the presidency. More tragedy.
Sadly, yes. His wife Jane died in 1863 from her long battle with tuberculosis. Then his close friend, Nathaniel Hawthorne, died in 1864 while they were actually traveling together.
That's rough. Hawthorne had controversially dedicated his last book to Pierce, hadn't he?
He had. Our Old Home caused quite a stir because Pierce was so unpopular by then. Pierce's own health declined, too, largely due to heavy drinking.
Alcoholism?
Seems so. He died of cirrhosis of the liver in 1869 at age 64. He did become more spiritual towards the end, getting baptized into the Episcopal Church, his wife's faith.
A difficult end to a difficult life. Was there any public reaction to his death?
There was. Interestingly, President Grant, the same Grant who defended his courage, declared a national day of mourning. So despite the controversy, he hadn't entirely vanished from public memory. There's one last flashpoint, too, after Lincoln's assassination.
Oh, what happened?
A mob gathered outside his house in Concord, demanding to know why he wasn't flying a flag for Lincoln. Pierce came out, apparently quite angry, but also patriotic, basically saying his record of service spoke for itself. It seemed to satisfy the crowd.
Huh. Still a complex figure, right to the end. So how do historians ultimately rate him? You mentioned the rankings earlier.
Yeah, the consensus is pretty bleak. Consistently ranked near the very bottom worst, least memorable. C-SPAN polls put him third to last. Historian Eric Foner called his administration one of the most disastrous in American history.
Ouch. Pretty damning.
Biographer Roy Nichols basically called him an accident, an inexperienced man trying his best but lacking the temperamental fitness for the job. The general view is that he was reactive, indecisive, and ultimately made the sectional crisis much worse.
So the overwhelming view is negative. But you mentioned diverse interpretations earlier. Not everyone blames him entirely.
Right. Some historians, like Peter Wallner, push back against laying it all at Pierce's feet. Wallner argues Pierce was fundamentally a nationalist, trying to find some middle ground, however flawed, to keep the Union together. He thinks it's unfair to blame him solely for failing to prevent the inevitable.
So maybe a tragic figure caught in impossible circumstances.
That's one perspective. But then you have others, like Larry Guerra, who say, okay, he worked hard, wasn't corrupt, but his policies on Cuba and Kansas were disastrous. They argue he just didn't understand the depth of anti-slavery feeling in the North, lacked the superhuman skills needed, and clung to an outdated view of the Constitution.
So the debate is really about agency versus historical forces. Was he a victim of his time, or did his own flaws and decisions make things significantly worse?
Exactly. Was he trying to navigate an impossible storm, or did he steer the ship directly onto the rocks? It's a complex question with no easy answer.
And yet, despite this terrible historical reputation, he's still memorialized, right?
Yeah.
Especially in New Hampshire.
He is. There's Franklin Pierce University, the Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property at UNH Law School. His family homestead is a historic site. There's even a statue of him at the state capitol.
It's kind of jarring, isn't it, given how poorly he's ranked as president? What does that tell us?
That's a great question. Is it just local pride? Acknowledging a native son who reached the highest office, regardless of his performance? Or maybe it just shows that history is complicated, and even figures seen as failures remain part of the story, part of the landscape.
Yeah, history isn't always neat and tidy. We remember the good, the bad, and the complicated.
Absolutely. So we've traced Franklin Pierce's journey from that charming young man marked by terrible personal loss to a president whose attempts to find compromise, particularly on slavery, arguably just fueled the fire.
A man of integrity in some ways, capable of administrative reform, yet whose political choices around Kansas, Nebraska, and the Fugitive Slave Act had devastating consequences.
It really forces you to think, doesn't it? In times of deep national division, especially over fundamental moral issues, can a leader truly find a middle ground if that ground requires compromising on justice?
Or does trying to appease everyone end up pleasing no one and making the underlying problem worse?
Right. How do you balance unity with conscience? It's a question that Pierce faced in the 1850s, and it's a question that in many ways we're still wrestling with today.
It certainly resonates.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into a complex and controversial presidency.